Government Operations and Elections Committee will come to order. Representative Quam, did you have a chance to review the minutes?
I was just doing that, and I would move for approval.
Representative Quam moves the minutes of Tuesday, February 14th. Do we have any corrections, comments? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. Members, we are going to take these bills a little bit out of order for time management reasons. We're going to start with the last bill, Senate File 134, Representative Beard. Good morning, Representative Beard.
Good morning, Madam
Chair. Would you like to move your
members.
Bill?
I'd like to, members, this is House File 212. Which I think it moved to the general register, and then I think we substituted Senate File 134 on the floor, did we not, Madam Chair? So we're moving actually Senate File 134, just to be clear, correct?
Oh, yes, it is Senate File 134.
Okay, well, Madam Chair and members, I'd like to move Senate File 134, move it back to the general register, recommend it pass, and go back to the general register.
Somewhere.
Madam Chair, if you'd like, I'd like to, we could refresh everyone's memory on the bill and just basically what it does.
Mm-hmm.
Members, this we have in law a provision that allows local government, local units of government to bring interns into the workplace. And we have some rather restrictive laws on how those interns are governed, believe it or not. We actually have a state statute that says how old they can be and how long they can be interns and do the intern experience. Senate File 134 lifts some of those requirements to match modern-day reality with so many of us not working for 40 years someplace and getting a gold watch. People are already going back and updating their education experience. Jobs change, situations change. And we have people that are over the age of 22 that are actually coming back into the workforce that might need some internship in their resume in order to move on with their degree or with filling out their resume for employment opportunities. Madam Chair, I also have with me Ms. Keith Carlson, who spoke well to this bill last year, who could also fill in maybe some more background on why I think it's a reasonable thing for us to do to adopt Senate File 134 and send it back to the register.
Okay, welcome to the committee, Mr. Carlson. If you could please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of 13 of the larger counties here in the state of Minnesota. I am appearing in support of this legislation. As Representative Beard said, we have this arbitrary age limit on the intern exception to PELRA, which basically applies from the 68th through the 100th day of work for those affected individuals. The character of our workplace, of our workforce, has changed substantially in the last 20 years, and it's no longer the practice that somebody goes to college immediately after graduating from high school and then moves on to the workplace, meeting the old age restrictions of this rule. We have many individuals who delay going to college or return to college in pursuit of a second career later on in their lives and need this experience to fulfill both their academic requirements as well as enhance their employment possibilities. One of the classes of individuals that would surely be affected by this is our returning service members. Right now, regardless of the fact that they've done service for our country, if they happen to be over this age 22, they do not benefit from this provision. So we highly recommend this this bill to the committee and hope that you will vote in favor of it.
Thank you. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carlson, it seems to me that the statute with the deletion that you're making or that would be made in this bill just seems a little bit kind of clunky. You're basically saying the same rules apply to everyone up to 100 days per year in a calendar year, and yet you've got this one and two, or this one or two kind of way of putting this together. If you just want to make internships be available to be longer than 67 days for anybody at any age, why don't we just change the statute to say how long an internship can be and then simplify this a lot?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, the legislation appears before you really addresses two different things. The clause, phrase one, that starts at the beginning of line 1.17 is for all individuals who are starting off in employment. Anybody who works less than 68 days is not subject to PELRA. They can't be subject to being fair shared. The other provisions of PELRA would not apply to them, regardless of whether they're an intern or not, regardless of their age. That's a general rule. The intern exemption, basically, if you read the two together, you know, starting with two towards the end of line 1.7, says for interns, individuals who are only full-time students or have indicated that they are going to return to school, that they have an additional, effectively, 33 days when they would not be subject to PELRA, basically fair share. If you want to expand that to all individuals, I'm certain that we would have no problem with that, but I'm not sure that you really want to do that.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I understand your point, but it just seems like we have a 67-day rule for general workers, and then we've got a 100-day rule for interns, and I'm not really sure what the rational reason is for those two numbers, and I understand that there are college students of multiple ages now. I just don't know what the basis for any of that is, why we come to those numbers. But maybe that's, you don't care, you just want to eliminate the age restriction.
Mr. Carlson?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, again, from our association's point of view, we would welcome making it 100 days for everybody, but again, I'm not sure that that's would be some of your desires.
Madam Chair, Representative Mr. Carlson, or 67 days for everyone.
Mr. Carlson?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, we feel the intern exception is an important criteria in the existing law to provide, again, these individuals the work experiences that they need to fulfill their academic requirements and, again, to give them the work experience that will enhance their future employment possibility. It's a very, as you've identified, relatively narrow thing. It only applies to full-time students or individuals who indicate they are going to return to college after completing that internship.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Mr. Carlson, one other thing I want to understand. So you have 100 working days. Does that mean 108-hour days, and can those be divided up? How does the definition of working days work? Because if you have a full-time student, I'm guessing they don't have 100 days a year full-time to intern for you. So does that get divided up over the whole year, or how does that all work?
Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, the 100 days is a day or portion of a day, so they don't get it's spread out over a year because they happen to work 4 hours or whatever.
Thank you. We did have one person that wanted to testify on my list, Laura Kushner, League of Cities.
Madam Chair, I think I do have another testifier that would like to shed some more light on the bill, if I may.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. If you could just please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Laura Kushner. I work for the League of Minnesota Cities. I'm their HR director. We are here to testify in support of this bill. We agree with Mr. Carlson's testimony. We think that what's relevant in this provision in the statute is that it's a full-time student, and we shouldn't really care what the age is. Full-time students can be over 22. Full-time students can be in their 50s. And we think the relevant part is the fact that it's a full-time student. And the one area that I might add a little bit on behalf of cities, I don't know the origins of this statute. I wasn't around when it was passed, but I suspect it is written this way because students would tend, at least the way cities would use full-time students, would tend to be in ice arenas or summer programs. So they may work at the golf course in the summer and then come back in the winter during winter break and work at the ice arena so that they need a few more days to stay under that 100 working day limit. I suspect that's the case. And I would be happy to answer any questions.
Madam Chair, I'm just going to ask, 100 days is basically summer vacation. Oh, by the way.
Okay. Did you have another witness, Representative Beard?
Madam Chair, those are the witnesses I have, but I think there are a few other folks who would like to speak about the bill.
Okay. Ms. Blyle, if you'd like to speak and identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Julie Blyle, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5. We are in opposition to the bill simply from the standpoint that it's another exception to PELRA. And if anyone has any doubt in their mind that PELRA is not under attack, they need to look at the bill introductions and the hearing schedules for the simple reason we just came from a hearing that they tried to interfere with PELRA. Here's another exemption. Every time we do that, we're moving away from the original intent of collective bargaining and protecting our employees.
Okay. Thank you. Any more questions for any of the witnesses yet? Are there additional folks who'd like to testify for or against the bill? Don't see anyone? Any other questions from members? Seeing no other questions, Representative Beard, would you like to renew your motion?
Sure. I renew my motion that Senate File 134 be recommended pass and placed back on the general register.
Representative Beard renewed his motion. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion does prevail. Next on the agenda, we will take up House File 1974. Representative Drazkowski is available. And I just wanted to remind folks, too, there's quite a few people here, so if you could, we need to tape this hearing, and if people clap or boo or anything like that, it makes it difficult to tape. So if you could just refrain from any of that type of behavior, that would be great. Representative Drazkowski, does your bill need to go to State Government Finance?
It does, Madam Chair.
I will move that House File 1974 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. To your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. House File 1974, members, relates to contract provisions within PELRA, contract provisions of state government contracts going forward after expiration. Here in Minnesota, we have a situation in our PELRA that we have discovered, certainly given the current negotiations, that says that if we have, and members, we haven't really run into this a lot in our history, but we have the situation now where the contracts for our two biggest unions have expired, and going forward, what we're seeing is the really what I would describe as kind of an autopilot for wages and the government's, the taxpayers' contribution to health insurance going forward, actually increasing even without a new contract being negotiated. And that's because of the design of the statutes, and certainly hasn't been looked at in the past because we haven't run into this situation. But members of the bill, if you look at it, the first, actually, line, subdivision 6, lines 1.9 through 1.18, or 1.20, excuse me, provide that after expiration a contract going forward that the parties may not agree in contract terms going forward relating to wage increases or employer insurance contribution increases will not be a practice anymore or allowed under PELRA. The effective date situation there, the effective date language actually, looks at and would provide that those two contracts and any other expired contracts currently would be frozen at current levels for wages and the employer's contribution to health insurance. And then the retroactivity provision, subdivision, or lines 2.3 through 2.7 provide that future contracts cannot provide for retroactive increases to wages and health insurance portion of the employer's contribution for health insurance. Anyway, that's the bill, members. We have some, we have, I can talk more about, you know, kind of the rationale behind the bill as we get into it here, or maybe I'll do that now. I talked about a little bit about the Subcommittee on Employee Relations, of which I am a member, and we are currently in negotiations with those contracts, with both the AFSCME and the MAPE contracts, the two largest contracts in state government. And those contracts seem to be very much stalled, at least the negotiations are stalled, and we have the point, we are at the point in time right now in our history, at least in the last 10 years that we have looked back. This is the longest duration that we have endured in those negotiations before we've actually had a contract to review and bring forward through the process. I think as we look at that, certainly Governor Dayton and his commissioners don't have the leverage, in, given the current economic situations going forward, that we see happen in normal private sector contracts. And so, members, this bill would bring us bring state government contract situations after contracts are expired into alignment with what we see in private sector contracts. We've got some, Madam Chair, we've got some testifiers, I think, that would like to talk about this from local government.
Thank you. We do have quite a list of testifiers, so if members would be okay, I would like to get some of the testifiers. And then if you do feel the need to interrupt, that's fine, but I just want to let you know I probably have about 10 people that want to testify, so just keep that in mind as you consider when to ask your questions. Representative Drazkowski, who's your first witness?
I believe Ms. Kelleher is from school boards.
And since we do have so many witnesses, if every witness could just bear in mind, if we could keep your comments to 2 or 3 minutes to be respectful of all the witnesses, that'd be greatly appreciated by the chair. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Kelleher, and please identify yourself for the tape before you proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. I'm Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We're here today supporting this resolution. In fact, we recently, in our delegate assembly, which is our grassroots reach out to members, had this resolution as one of the ones adopted, and 108-14 vote. So that shows true support here. School districts have run across this problem in dealing with arbitrators. In fact, there are 12 arbitrator decisions my staff has run across that has listened to the school district's arguments, basically that contracts have expired and no salary schedule is in place. The argument that the school board has not improved annual increments in salary, and the collective bargaining agreement does not entitle an employee to automatic step increases and lane advancements. And the arbitrators have said that is not a very persuasive argument. So in end, folks, when in fact we have arbitrator recent decisions that have this kind of force and effect, school boards are left with a very unbalanced table when we're negotiating contracts. And we would just appreciate this law, which in fact says the contract ends when it ends. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Kelleher, tell me that, all right, when the contract ends, what is going to happen next then? They do not, there's no continuing contract, they don't keep working?
Ms. Kelleher?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Representative Erdahl, there is a continuing contract provision, but the automatic step and lanes and medical benefits would not be agreed upon until they were voted on by the union and the school district. So the old contract provisions would remain in place until there was a new solution.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That isn't the way it was in the past. I mean, I thought when I was teaching that when we continued on, that I did not get my step and lane increases until the new contract.
Ms. Kelleher.
Madam Chairman, Representative Erdahl, I am sure when you were teaching that was the fact. These are recent arbitrator decisions. In fact, I can give you one. It's Minneapolis Federation of Teachers versus the Bureau of Mediation, case number 10-PA-0859. And it's a recent decision that says those timelines that always have held, and we always felt read, what you're speaking of, that basically the contract doesn't go up until there's a new one ratified, are not correct, and those arguments were unpersuasive by school districts in coming before the arbitrator.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Kelleher, I didn't have any problems with that when I was teaching. I mean, I understood that I just am under the last contract, where I was until the next contract is approved. So, am I agreeing with you?
Yes, you are.
Not with Draskowski, though.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you for coming. Oh, Ms. Kelleher, Representative Simon does have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess this would apply, and you, unfortunately, Ms. Kelleher, you're the first testifier. I'm sure there are others who will kind of echo what you're saying. But for anyone who's on the management side, whether it's school boards or anyone else, can't you contract around this? I mean, if you don't want step and lane increases or health benefit increases or wage increases, can't management of any kind put that in the contract? Can't that be a management position?
Ms. Kelleher.
Madam Chairwoman, Representative Simon, school districts, and if I can give you a lengthier background, have clause language that basically says this contract ends at the end of the agreement date, and the arbitrator still didn't find that convincing, and I can give you the exact language on that. If you wait a couple minutes, I can provide that to you.
Well,
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that, and I'll take it your word that that's what the arbitrator said. Maybe what those arbitration decisions are telling management is that if they really want that, they need to be more explicit. And that's easy to do. I mean, I think any of us here, it seems to me, could take a couple of minutes and noodle on a piece of paper and come up with very explicit language that says, you know, when the contract is over, it really means over, and here's what over means, and over means no step and lane increases. I mean, management can do that. That's all part of a negotiation. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, I don't know that we should be in the business here of correcting for management's inability to see ahead that this might be a problem. I don't doubt that an arbitrator might say, look, this is ambiguous. It says the contract ends, but it's not explicit enough about what that really means. But that's not our fault, and it's certainly not the fault of collective bargaining units who are trying to do the best for their members. I think what we're talking about here, and again, I don't mean to pick on you or your organization. I suspect we'll hear from other management people. You have the misfortune of going first. But I think just generally speaking, if what this is really about is saying management didn't see ahead that they needed something more explicit to accomplish the outcome that they wanted, and an arbitrator said that they drafted a contract that they freely negotiated too vaguely, and we're here to sort of bail them out after the fact because they didn't see ahead. They just did. They weren't as explicit as they should have been, according to a judge or an arbitrator, then that's really not our fault. And I don't see why we would, it's not our job to go in and correct that for management or, frankly, for labor either. I think the idea is you've got two parties who are freely negotiating in a collective bargaining process, and the fact that management may not have drafted correctly or well enough, I don't know that that's necessarily any of our business.
Ms. Kelleher?
Madam Chairwoman, Representative Simon, I think what you're asking me is more of a political question. The language, here's the demonstration of the language I referred to earlier, and thereafter until a new agreement is reached. And I certainly, the school board thought they had a meaning of that. Labor thought they had a meaning of it. I would ask for some intervention on your part to say what you mean with that. And we could spend money not on attorneys, but on kids. So if you just let us know how you'd like to do it. I don't think we're unwilling to come up. We just want to know what the rules are. And when arbitrators are setting the rules, we find it difficult to implement at the local level.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess, Ms. Kelleher, I could kind of buy your argument of what you're talking about on that piece of it, of this bill, but I guess the part of the bill that I got questioned about is the retro part of it, the retroactivity. And I see this, having participated in bargaining contracts, both in the public and private sector, you're basically giving employers the free hand to delay coming to an agreement, delay a contract, possibly going to more strikes, because right now retro pay is part of the bargaining issue, and now you're taking that out of the thing. We're telling you can't give back pay, you can't give retroactive pay, because when you come to an agreement, so it just creates a situation where you're allowing employers that say, well, we just won't negotiate a contract. And if we go 2, 3, 4 years and not come to an agreement with the teachers, they're still going to teach for us. We're going to pay them on what the old contract with no raises, and we don't have to pay them back pay. So it basically gives a big tool, a big advantage to the employer side of the equation. And it, to me, that's more of an issue, or that's a bigger issue here. I mean, I could kind of agree or understand what you're coming at with the other part of it. If this is what the understanding you had for years, and now an arbitrator's changed that, like Representative Simon said, we could fix that piece of it with language that I don't, that would be less obtrusive than this one here, that this is getting in the middle of contract negotiations and the collective bargaining side of the equation. So,
Ms. Keller?
Madam Chairman, Representative Nelson, you raised some good quality points. I would say local school boards who are elected by their community feel it is very inherent to get contracts done and keep teachers in the classroom teaching our kids. These unsettled contracts and being a mean employer when you're elected official, it's virtually impossible when you serve that community. And once again, if we could have some clarity on the issue, on what was intended and how this would play out, it would be very beneficial. The present state of the law, this unclarity in it, isn't helping us get any farther down the road. So in the end, I can't argue with your logic or your theory, but local boards really do try hard with their local communities to come to good answers, not only for the school district and the kids, but for the employees. We need teachers teaching our kids.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And like I said, I think especially the clause, or sections, or subdivision 7 here on page 2.3, starting in point 2.3, I think that's going to create more work stoppages, there's no contract, and more strikes because we're not going to come to an agreement. So I think this is going to be counter to what you're trying to do in trying to create harmonious working relationships between our teachers and our public employees and the community that they work for. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Keller, what I hear you saying is that arbitrators have been making decisions that you think are questionable and may well be questionable, but that the solution is for the legislature to prescribe a certain rule about how, or a law, not a rule, to pass a law to say how these decisions or how these outcomes have to be arrived at. And I wonder if you think every time an arbitrator makes a bad question or a bad decision, we should be coming back and trying to pass a law to correct it, or is there some other reform in the system, or is the certain level of imperfection something is that has to be expected? I mean, certainly as a lawyer, I can tell you that courts don't always make the right decision. I wouldn't expect in labor negotiations an arbitrator is always going to make the right decision, and a certain amount of imperfection is what you risk. You know, you roll the dice when you go to an arbitrator, you roll the dice when you go to a court. You're not always going to get the perfect outcome, but I'm not sure that every time that happens we should go to the legislature and ask us to pass a law to settle that question. So are there other better ways of dealing with this than this bill? Because I don't think the legislature is all that good at things like this.
Amen.
Ms. Kelleher.
Madam Chairman, Representative Winkler, you bring good points. I think there's a common sense ending that our communities and the public we serve believe that when the contract deadline is reached, there is some halt until a new contract is ratified with new salary and benefit terms. And teachers operate in a step in lane where they go up and over. And if they are, in fact, automatically given, regardless of when that contract ends, we have a hard time telling our public that and sharing that our work on contract and contract negotiations is purposeful and a well-spent time for board members and staff. So it's a bigger question, and we think there's some inherent common sense within this bill that reaches out to our community at large.
Ms. Keller, I guess my only comment would be that the collective bargaining process and the labor relations act that we operate under is probably a better way of resolving that than bringing common sense things like this to the legislature, because the past history shows that negotiations and labor settlements are much smoother now than they were before we had PELRA. And I think if there are adjustments to PELRA that are necessary to account for rogue arbitrators, I think we'd be better off dealing with that issue than trying to kind of short-circuit that and come here. So that, anyway, I think even if it seems common sense, there are, it's a whole can of worms that you open up by going down that path.
Representative Hornstein?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think Representative Nelson's question, you know, peaked one for me, which is what happens, and it's either for the author or Ms. Kelleher, what happens if, you know, there's no contract agreed on by this very specific date? Would you then be free to go out and hire non-union employees? You know, in the event, you know, when Representative Nelson talked about a strike, then, you know, there's all kinds of shenanigans that can go on with management and a strike in terms of outsourcing and bringing in people. So what happens, what's your vision of what happens if this date, this hard and fast date, isn't set? Strikes, union busting, outsourcing, what happens?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hornstein, you know, what this bill does is basically, the contracts, for instance, the state contracts expired on June 30th. And this part of law says specifically that those provisions in those contracts are to extend forward. What this bill does is says the increases that were there in there cannot extend forward. So people would still continue to receive the same wages they were all the way into infinity until the next contract was agreed upon at the same rate they were at. They just wouldn't be able to have steps applied, and the government or the taxpayers would just not be responsible for additional health care costs above what were in the original contract that expired on June 30th. I don't know if that's helpful, but that's...
Oh. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. I just think that this opens up a whole can of worms in terms of, as Representative Winkler said, interference in collective bargaining, and as Representative Nelson said, real potential to put a real damper on labor management relations by, I think, creating a real bias towards management in these negotiations. But that's my concern, and I think once you head down that road, then there's all kinds of shenanigans that can go on. So just wanted to express that concern, and I think we're going to hear more from people about that as well.
Thank you for being willing to take all those questions, Ms. Kelleher. Representative Drazkowski, I've got a list of supporters and opponents. Would you like to take them every other one, or do you have a specific person you want next, or how do you want to work that?
Madam Chair, Laura Kushner from LMC, League of Minnesota Cities, is ready to go, I think, sort of, if that works.
Okay, we'll do it that way. Welcome to the committee again. If you could identify yourself again, too, that would be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Laura Kushner with the League of Minnesota Cities. I'm the HR director there. I would also just like to mention that I was previously the chief negotiator for the cities of Maple Grove, Roseville, and Crystal, so I do have a labor relations background as well. The League would like to testify in favor of the first provision in this bill. We do not have a position on the second provision. We do feel that, I think some of the remarks made by the committee members are very appropriate, good remarks. I think in general a lot of our cities would agree that the collective bargaining process works when it's allowed to work, and that when you have an even playing field, then it can work very well. However, we feel this provision in the law puts cities at a very unfair advantage, and it has become more clear to us in difficult economic times how much of an disadvantage this provision puts us at, because there is no incentive for a union to bargain on issues when the contract just keeps moving forward. For example, if you have a collective bargaining provision that says that the employer will contribute 90% of health care costs, that keeps moving forward with each contract under this provision. So as the health insurance increases, the employer just has to keep paying 90%. They don't have a real, true opportunity to bargain on that. In these times, cities need the opportunity to step back from the contract and say what makes sense in these economic times and what doesn't. It's not that they're not willing to bargain on those issues. They are very willing to bargain on those issues. They want an even playing field. They want an end in time where they can step back and say, okay, what is fair in this day and age? Not what was fair in 1975. What's fair in 2012? So that's why we would like this provision in the law, so that we cities can really do a good job for our taxpayers and make sure that the provisions make sense in this day and age.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the testifier, I'm looking at the current law here. This is current law on House File 1974. And I think the key thing is line 1.10. It is true that current law allows for this kind of continuation or even increase, but it says if the parties agree. So it says during the period after contract expiration prior to the date when the right to strike matures and for additional time if the parties agree, then this sort of parade of horribles happens. And I guess I'll just reemphasize the point I made earlier, then just don't agree. Then drive a hard bargain, negotiate well and better, and draft more explicit and more specific contract provisions that make very clear that you, management, don't agree, and that you are negotiating and holding out for the fact that, no, when it's over, it really means over, and you're going to write it very clearly and specifically and explicitly so that everyone is crystal clear when you negotiate. And when you're up against a union, you can say, I'm sorry, this is our firewall. We are not going to agree to a contract where you get one dime more of anything after the contract is expired. You can do that under current state law. All management can do that. So what I'm hearing today is that management was not as adept as they should have been or could have been, not as explicit or specific or crystal clear as they could have been, and arbitrators are saying there's enough vagueness there and ambiguity that maybe the better, safer thing to do is to allow those SEP or lane increases or other increases to go through. And what I'm hearing is management saying, we made a mistake, we didn't negotiate well, we weren't tough enough, and now we want the legislature to bail us out. Those words matter here. It says, if the parties agree, all this stuff can happen. So all of what we're hearing today is the result of the parties having agreed to this outcome, or at least in the mind of an arbitrator, they weren't specific enough about what they agreed on. So I guess the message today is, if management of any kind has a problem with this, be tougher. Be a better negotiator, whether it's a school board or a city or a county. Say that you're not going to do this, no way, no how, and that can be your negotiating position. And after the fruition of the negotiating process, you either will or won't get your way on that. But I'm just puzzled here. I mean, the statute's very clear. This only happens if the parties agree. And when they don't agree, that's because management agreed that they wouldn't agree on it. So I just don't know why we're here to correct the mistakes of management in not drafting their contracts specifically enough. That's what I'm seeing here, and I don't know why we're spending time on that. I don't think we do it the other way.
Ms. Kushner?
Madam Chair, thank you. My understanding of that provision is that it modifies the phrase before that. First of all, I should clarify I'm not an attorney, so if I'm wrong about this, I apologize. But my understanding is that for additional time if the parties agree modifies the phrase before that, so it says up until the date when the right to strike matures and for additional time beyond the date when the right to strike matures if both parties agree. So you have to go at least until the right to strike matures, and you can go beyond that if both parties agree. That's my understanding. The second thing I would like to say is that it would be, I cannot really imagine what would be in it for the union to agree to a provision that would get rid of this kind of language in the contract. I think that this is wonderful language for them to have if they have these steps and these 90% provisions in there. And with this provision in the law, I don't really know how a member of management could ever get out of this without a change in the law. I don't know why or how a union would agree to language that says we no longer get this. That's the level playing field we're asking for.
Madam Chair.
Representative Drozdowski.
I will just add, thank you, Madam Chair, that and maybe Mr. Shepherd can help us, but as I remember discussing this with folks, impasse has to be identified first by one of the parties, and then notice has to be given, 10 days notice, I believe. So there is, you know, it's certainly not during that time. You want to encourage the negotiations to continue, and that is written in there to encourage that. The other thing I would mention is that, again, the private sector union contracts do not have this situation. I've got three of them here if anybody wants to look at them, but they do have, at least the ones I've looked at, do have the ability for those conditions in the old contract to continue beyond the expiration, but the provisions in the old contract don't have steps. They don't have, they don't lock you into, as an employer, into a 90% health insurance provision. It's written, you know, it's hard-coded in, $7 an hour for insurance, and that's fixed. So those are fixed on that side. On these provisions in government contracts are not fixed. And so that therein lies our problem, and that's the reason behind the design of the bill.
Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, I appreciate that, and you may be right about some of that. I guess my overall point, and I know we have other testifiers to get to, is, you know, these contracts are the result of hard negotiations, I would imagine, often, where both sides take sometimes extreme, sometimes ridiculous positions in the course of a negotiation. They soften, they harden, they walk out, they come together, and at the end, both sides sign on the dotted line that this is what they've agreed to. And what I'm hearing is that arbitrators have said that there isn't enough specificity to really determine what that meaning is. And so the answer to that seems to be more specific, or to bargain harder. I know it's easy for me to say, I'm not in the room, but the point is, if this is really important, if this provision of over means over is really important, then it ought to be bargained for. And it's one of dozens or hundreds of positions on dozens of hundreds of issues that can be taken in any negotiation. Same goes for any of us negotiating the price of a house or a car. If that's important to you, then make it important enough to spell out explicitly. And it just seems to me that we're here to kind of correct the negotiating errors of those who wish they had been more specific. That's all.
Okay. And here, a question there exactly. So we'll move on to the next question. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Drazkowski, returning to the world that I knew before once again, which is teacher contracts. And as I understand this, there's no retroactive pay. You know, teachers you know, working under the old contract, new contract settled, they're not going to get the difference between. Is that correct?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Erdahl, that's what the bill says. There's not going to be retroactive components of the new contract to make up for that. Again, written in order to create, as has been mentioned by previous testifiers, a level playing field like we have in the private sector contract.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Drazkowski, that's the same argument that we heard when we removed the January 15th settlement deadline, saying that we're leveling the playing field. My concern that I have with this is that, you know, knowing how negotiations work in education, that you have your two-year contract, you start that next year in beginning of September, end of August, you're under the old contract, but you're going to go, and they did this year, they blew past, you know, I think, at least half of our school districts, the January 15th deadline. There are a lot of school districts that haven't settled yet. And you're getting to the point where, you know, you're looking at a half to two-thirds, well, not that much, but a third to a half of a contract that they're not going to get any retroactive pay for. So I have some problems with that, Representative Drazkowski. No, I will likely be supportive of what you're doing here today, but I think that we need to have a chat about this particular provision as to, you know, are we now, by removing the January 15th and becoming more, you know, leveling the playing field, are we now artificially tipping it more the other way? We can have that discussion.
Okay, you can discuss that offline. Representative Scalzi.
Well, thank you, Ms. Chair. I think we're kind of losing track of really what we're talking about here, and I'm hoping we can hear from some teachers maybe from some police officers. We hear management and union, but we sometimes forget that these are real people. They're frontline people. In 2012, these are tough jobs. It's different than it was 30 years ago. These people are teaching our kids. They're keeping us safe. They're fighting our fires. I think that we want them to be healthy and happy, and I don't just see that why the legislature should be mucking up collective bargaining. I just don't see it. I think the law, as Representative Simon says, takes care of it. And once we start mucking it up, we're going to be here every year because we're going to hear from teachers, we're going to hear from police officers, because they've maybe felt that they didn't get heard. And I certainly hope we hear them today. That's, I guess, a comment more than a question.
Yeah, and remember, Representative Salzy, we do have representatives from MAPE and AFSCME and firefighters that are going to talk. I don't know that there's teachers per se, but there are other folks. We do, we'll just keep the list of Drazkowski supporters, and then we'll, when we work through whatever Representative Drazkowski wants to, then we'll go to the opponents. Mr. Carlson?
Madam Chair, again, I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, whose membership in Boost 13 in the state's larger counties. Our organization has had a formal position in support of Section 1 of this bill for 2 years now. And I do want to clarify what this does and does not do. What it doesn't do is stop pay for the affected individuals on the contract expiration. Their pay would continue at the current level. Nor does it have any effect on the employer's contribution towards their benefits. That contribution would continue at the level in effect at the expiration of that contract. It has no effect on the grievance processes. The grievance processes under the expired contract would continue, and that's frankly something that employers as well as employees desire. What it does do is, as Ms. Kushner said, is remove the leg up that unions have currently. Contrary to what Representative Simon has said, this law controls regardless of what the contract says. So even though the contract says that its provisions expire upon the expiration of the contract, this says all the provisions of the contract continue. And those could include steps and lanes, increases in employers' contributions to the insurance plans, which may be exactly what we want to negotiate with the employees as employers. With regards to what time frame is, the unions control the clock. Until they give notice, 10 days notice of their intent to strike, this provision applies. And so if they simply fail to do that notice, which could be weeks, it could be months, it could be years, the automatic increases in the bill for wages and salary, in the contract for wages and salaries and contracts would continue in effect under the current law unless you adopt this. With that, I'll conclude. Again, we support, strongly support Section 1 of this bill.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carlson, my understanding, and maybe I'm wrong, but my understanding is that in order for a right to strike to mature, one or both sides has to declare an impasse. And that's at the discretion of either the employer or the or management or labor. Is that not correct?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, Representative, again, for the right to fully mature, the union has to give notice of intent to strike. And until such time that that notice has been given, the right to strike has not matured. So again, it's in the employee's hands to dictate when the clock has run.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Mr. Carlson, sorry. But on the flip side, if management continues to negotiate and employees are paying a higher share of health care costs because they're not allowed to go up, presumably the premiums and other things are going to go up, and you know, there are steps and lanes, I guess, in teacher contracts, but no across-the-board increases to account for inflation. If those things are all in place, isn't management fully equally capable under this provision, under this bill, of just holding out until they make the employees pay enough of a price that they can then finally negotiate? I mean, as long as negotiations continue, there's no impasse and there's no right to strike. So it seems to me that both sides have an equal ability to control the clock. And under this provision, you're basically saying that the employees are going to continue to exist under the previous contract, which may create an economic burden on them.
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, Representative, again, the final step that has to occur before the right to strike matures is the union has to give notice. They unilaterally control that. So, you know, the example you gave of while the steps and lanes continues, that appears to me to be disadvantageous to the employer. If there are no steps and lanes in the contract, if there's no increase in the employer contribution to employee benefits, then, you know, this issue is relatively moot. But if there are, and obviously that's common in almost every school district contract, and there are a number of county and city contracts where that situation would exist, we're at a fundamental disadvantage.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Mr. Carlson, I don't understand that. In order for the right to strike to mature, there has to be an impasse. So an impasse requires one or both sides to declare an impasse. And if as long as the negotiations are continuing, as long as management continues to negotiate, if it takes 3 years and they're still negotiating and no impasse has occurred, the employees would be the ones under pressure economically, because there would be no inflationary increases to their salaries. There would be no adjustments to health care benefits based on health care inflation. So, yes, you're correct. The right to strike occurs when there's the 10-day notice. But before that, you have to get to impasse. And when you to get to impasse, you need both sides to be at impasse, and then you can challenge it if there isn't an impasse. So it seems to me that what you're doing is taking something that seems relatively neutral, and you're shifting it to weigh in factor of management, maybe not by leaps and bounds under Section 1, but you're pushing it a little bit that direction. And I don't understand why this isn't, why we're not on neutral ground under current law. Because you don't have to put steps and lanes in a contract. You don't have to put a 90% health care contribution in a contract in the first place.
Madam Chair, Representative, I guess we're just going to have to fundamentally disagree. Again, the final step to create the right to strike is the union's declaration of intent to strike. And they control that. The employer has no effect on that. And the issue for us is, if we do have these automatic increases, these automatic increases in contributions, that we're at a fundamental disadvantage while that interim between either declaration of the strike or a contract is negotiated, that those increased costs to us and increased benefits or salaries or wages to employees would occur during that interim period.
Okay, Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carlson, I hate to put you on the spot, but could you give us your opinion on Section 2 of this bill?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, Representative McFarland, our organization has no formal provision on that, so I do not have a formal position to present to the committee on that. So.
Thank you. I'd like to move to the next testifier. Jeff Spartz.
I don't know if he's here or not, Madam Chair, and I don't know if they were going to testify or not. I didn't get a chance to talk to him.
Okay, then.
Just a moment. He indicated to me they're neutral on the bill,
okay.
So he won't be testifying.
Okay.
Madam Chair,
could we just clarify
who's
the record?
Who are neutral?
Representative Raskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize, Representative Winkler, the Association of Minnesota Counties.
Gary Carlson, is he here? Want to testify?
Ms. Kushner covered for him, Ms. Madam Chair.
Okay. I think we'll go to some opponents now. Dana Wheeler. Welcome to the committee, and if you could just identify yourself for the table.
Sure. My name is Dana Wheeler. I'm Executive Director for the Minnesota Government Engineering Council. We're a group of about 1,000 state employees in the engineering, land surveying, and technical fields.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. MGC opposes this bill. It limits an employer's opportunities to incent employees and to fairly compensate employees. It treats those who do work for the state differently from as state employees than those who also do work for the state who are in the private sector and have separate contracts with the state. It will lead to unreasonably and unnecessarily artificial timelines, not only for the collective bargaining process, but for the resolution of issues that are in the due process of the as outlined by the agreements. By limiting insurance premium adjustments, it removes the shared responsibility for the state's self-directed and self-insured insurance programs, placing all the burden for any increases solely on the employees. The bill is not good for the state employees. I also want to just reaffirm some of the testimony previously given that the agreements are reached through a lot of hard work by both the employees and the administration. And the administration has chosen, whether it be Republican, Democrat, or independent, to include this provision in prior contracts because they've seen that at times it serves us both well. And so I think that what we need to do is encourage folks to continue to use the collective bargaining process to give them topics to think ahead about, but not hamper the hands of either side by eliminating the opportunity for them to negotiate something that might serve the employer and employees well, as it has in the past.
Thank you. Okay, I don't see any questions yet. We'll move on to the next witness. And again, I just want to remind all the remaining testifiers, if you could limit it to a couple of minutes, since we do have a list here, that'd be great. The next on my list is Russ Stanton. Welcome to the committee, and if you could just identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Russ Stanton. I am Director of Government Relations for the Interfaculty Organization, which is the State University Faculty Union, here to testify against the 1974. By way of background, for those of you who might be new and don't know about our organization, I think we hold the record for having the soonest the earliest settlement of a contract. The last contract we settled 6 months before the expiration of the old contract. There was nothing to negotiate for, and so we skipped that round of bargaining and just continued the contracts forward. We're not opposed to settling a contract early. In fact, folks like that, to have some certainty in terms of what their compensation is going to be and so they get the pay raises. Also, by way of background, we don't have any automatic step increases in our contract, across the board step increases. We have two kinds of step increases that do have an effect. One is we have what we call career steps, where people get steps after 10 years, 20 years, and 30 years that are automatic. That was put in for salary decompression reasons several years ago, and they're scheduled to expire, that provision, in 2013. But the second kind of steps that we have in our contract, or increases there, is promotional increases. When a person is promoted from assistant to associate or associate to full professor, that's usually it's always based on a professional development plan, extensive peer review. People work for years on those professional development plans to get their promotion. And if this legislation were to pass, basically, even though the employer and the employee and the union are all in agreement, this person should get their promotion. They wouldn't be able to get their promotion until the contract, if the contract was in extension. Now, so why don't we just settle our contract? Well, it isn't always within your means to settle a contract. It's influenced by outside factors. One of them is our health care plan, which is a major portion of the contract, is done through coalition bargaining. And until that portion of the contract is settled, we don't know what the rest of the contract, you know, it's very difficult to negotiate the rest of the contract on it. You know, we have budgetary things, and quite frankly, one of the major impediments to settling the contract this time is the legislature. You know, how can you settle a contract when people are introducing bills to override PELRA, to take away health care benefits, to take away severance pay, to take away, to shift who pays how much on the pension plans and so forth? All of that impacts it. And how can you negotiate a contract that you can sell to your members to ratify when all of this is in play? It's a major impediment. You know, we have, I think, pretty good working relationships with our employer. We've never had a strike. Yeah, we do fight once in a while, but, you know, we're currently in interest-based bargaining. We're making as much progress as we can on language items, and I think both sides would say we're making good progress, but it is very difficult in this environment. And I think the best way to get a contract settlement is to let PELRA work. I guess I would just end my testimony with a plea. You know, the last year I have spent an incredible amount of time testifying before legislative committees over compensation issues, terms and conditions of employment and so forth, and bills that overrode PELRA. This is a terrible, terrible environment to try to work out compensation issues. It's not objective. It's highly politicized. Most of the votes are along party line. It's a clumsy, awful way to deal with employees. We have PELRA for a reason. You know, it is an orderly process for the people most involved to work out the differences. And I guess it's just a plea, let it work. Thank you.
Thank you. Next on my list I have Brian Rice.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Brian Rice. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters and the Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis. I am a lawyer. I've negotiated a number of contracts. I've also worked for the State Highway Patrol troopers, the BCA agents, game wardens, and gambling agents. Mr. Hodep and his president are here. I'm not speaking on their behalf today, but I think this committee needs to get a couple facts straight. First off, you're really dealing with about three levels here. You're dealing with state. This provision applies to three general types of contracts: your state employees, school districts, cities and counties, and others. I'm not an expert on the school district issue, and I won't speak to that. Ms. Schwab addressed some of those issues. I'm not familiar with that decision. But let me just say, this is a very, very radical bill. You're upending a fundamental cornerstone of PELRA. And that law has been well settled for a long time, and it's worked well. The number of continuation issues as a percentage of the contracts you're talking about in the state is very small. But the provision of continuing labor terms is fundamental to delivering public service in this state. And if you adopt this bill, you're going to create chaos on many levels. I'd like to correct Representative Simon. You're correct. Mr. Carlson indicated that the unions have the ability to move a strike. The operative provision of that law is 179A.18, and a strike can occur in the following circumstances. The collective bargaining agreement between the exclusive representative and their employees has expired. That's the main cornerstone. Or there's no agreement, which means you've formed a new entity. So once the agreement has expired, that's trigger one. Trigger two is that there's been mediation between the two parties. So I have to disagree respectfully with Mr. Carlson on that point. So Representative Simon and members of the committee, it's my view from having negotiated these contracts that Mr. Carlson's testimony is inaccurate. And as far as the issue about payment, if you read this bill, the real key thing, you're talking about pay raises and automatic pay raises, but a contract ends, if you look at line 1.2 of the bill, 1.12, it says that the contract continues except for B. 1.3 says B. A contract does not continue in effect and is not enforceable after the expiration date of the contract. Independent clause. And the parties may not agree to extend or honor a contract term beyond the expiration date of the contract if the contract would provide a wage or salary increase to the employee, including but not limited increases, cost of living, longevity, education, training, or performance merit, or provide an increase in dollar contribution to things. So if a contract has any increase in it, it can't continue. What that means is the only way you'll keep these grievances provisions that Mr. Carlson testified and work rules and everything else is if the union simply say, okay, we're working for no increase. Talk about a fair playing field, not true. The only way you get to keep your grievance procedure, your work rules, your seniority rules, and everything else is if a union says, we'll work for no wage increases. That is not fair. Simply not fair. I'd also have to say about evening the playing field, every contract that I've worked on, there's a continuation clause. And it's been agreed to by the parties. And Representative Simon, you're correct. The parties can agree. If they don't want a wage increase, say there's no wage increase. And you can do that at the bargaining table. The League of Cities, the counties, apparently the school districts are coming here asking you to fix their problem. Well, you know, they did that last year, too, when they dealt with Homestead Market Value Credit, and they gave testimony on how that was going to work out. And I tell you, when you pulled that thread on the garment of finance, it didn't work out well. And this is even a bigger threat. I specifically have, and even on this provision, while it says the right to mature accrues, the people I represent are essential employees, and they don't have a right to strike. But this provision in the law has been relied on and referenced in our essential employee agreements for the continuation provision. If you amend this and take this out, you're going to leave the essential employees, police and the fire, naked with no reference in PELRA to what the continuation clause. And talk about what an arbitrator might do or what a court might do when you deal with this section. You're going to leave police and fire in this state in a circumstance where do we have continuation provisions or not. So I think that this bill is drastic. It's radical. It's going to have major effects throughout the state, in cities, counties, public employees throughout. And lastly, and I'll end my testimony on this, Section 2 will, every police and firefighter, every essential employee in the state will be affected. Section 2 says on line, page 2, line 3, an employer may not enter into a contract and an arbitrator may not issue an interest arbitration award that would retroactively provide a wage or salary increase or retroactively provide an increase in the dollar amount of employee contributions for benefits. A very small fraction of essential employee contracts, police, fire, nurses in some cases, are settled by arbitrators. What that simply means is that, okay, we're going to stall you out. We're not going to settle your contract. We'll go to arbitration. I've had contracts that have been a year and a half, 2 years expired, and the arbitrator will rule and say, okay, no pay raise for the cop, even if an arbitrator says you should get it. That's just wrong. Just absolutely dead wrong. I'd have to concur with what Mr. Statton said. These are difficult times, but I think we've worked through a lot of these difficult times. I mean, wages have not been increasing for police and fire. We've lost police and fire throughout the state. I testified here a year ago. There's no doubt that public employment in the state is shrinking. That's evidenced by all the pension statistics, that there are fewer people in the system. There have been layoffs. R.T. Ryback fired 10 firefighters last year. Cops have not increased. Wages have been at zero. Arbitration awards. There was another terrible bill that was introduced last year. Over half of all the arbitration cases, there are zero increases awarded to public employees. In the other cases, the other 30% of them, the wages increases were less than 1%. I mean, how much do you have to crush public employees until the system works, is what my testimony is. And to make fundamental changes to PELRA, a law that's served this state well for 40 years, at this point in time, I just think is bad public policy.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. Next on the list is Mr. Kajewski from MAPE. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Richard Kajewski. I am the Director of Public Affairs and Communications for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. In my capacity, I represent 13,000 of the state's professional degreed employees. And I'll keep it real brief because a lot of my comments have already been mentioned. I think there's a piece of education that everybody needs to understand. It's not myself, it's not my boss, or anybody else who's employed at the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees who negotiates our contract. These are members who negotiate our contract who are elected by the rest of the members in our union. There's 26 people on our collective bargaining team. They negotiate it. We heard from Assistant Commissioner Barb Holmes, the state's chief negotiator at the Legislative Coordinating Commission, talk about the number of negotiating meetings that have taken place with the state of Minnesota and their labor unions. And we heard the testimony from her that said it's been consistent with past bargaining years. And I heard from Representative Drazkowski talk about, well, this is the longest it's ever taken. And that's true, members. But we went through a 20-day shutdown, and that's the reason for the delay. Meetings were canceled going up into the shutdown to prepare for the shutdown. And members of our bargaining team were laid off as a result of the government shutdown. So until they returned to work and became acclimated and we could reschedule dates, there was a huge delay in the collective bargaining process. It's now moving. This bill here punishes the employees for the contract not being completed at the end of the expiration period. And it just so happens our contract expires on June 30th of 2011. And then the shutdown happened. And that's the duration of our contract. We don't control that. And so, once again, this bill is going to punish state employees, half of which lost 5%, in excess of 5% of their annual pay last year, and are not getting it back. And it takes a piece, if the contract doesn't get settled till October, let's say, everyone who's entitled to a step increase between July and October doesn't get it until October and gets no retro pay. While if your performance evaluation, an increase goes in December, you get it. You don't lose anything. This bill punishes people for no decision of their own. And I've heard the argument, well, we don't like that steps continue, and it's just automatic. Steps are based on people's performance. And steps in our last collective bargaining agreement under the Pawlenty administration, which most of you at this table voted in favor of, were non-existent the first year and existed the second year. There was no hard freeze. That administration could have negotiated that in the contract. What we're living under now with the step increases is the negotiated contract from that administration that most of you at this table voted in favor of. So members, I just say, I heard it from Representative Winkler, I've heard it from, so members, I just say, I heard it from Representative Winkler, I've heard it from previous testifiers, I've heard it from Representative Simon today, this bill absolutely infringes on our collective bargaining process. And we could talk about the health care increases all we want, as long as we're negotiating in good faith and there's no unfair labor practice filed by either party, and health care increases come about, management has every right to negotiate how those increases are shared across the table. There's nothing stopping them, just like the step increases. So with that, Madam Chair, I would urge everyone not to support this bill. We are not in favor of it, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Move on to the next testifier. Elliot Side, MapsMeet. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Elliot Side. I'm the Executive Director of MapsMeet Council 5. I represent 43,000 workers in state, local government, nonprofits, and quasi-agencies. Madam Chair, MapsMeet Council 5 firmly opposes this bill in its entirety. I completely support the statements that were made by Mr. Stanton, Mr. Rice, and Mr. Kajewski. I think they're very accurate. I think Mr. Simon and Mr. Winkler, Madam Chair, have articulated the issues that management could be doing. I'm sitting here today as a union negotiator who negotiates the state contracts, but I've negotiated others, and listening to management, apparently they don't know how to negotiate a contract, because I could think of ways to include language in the contract that would make sure that the provisions that they want worried about continuing won't continue. Now, they may have to trade something to get it, or they may have to force us into a situation, but they certainly could do it. I think what Representative Drazkowski here is guaranteed that instead of having labor peace like PELRA has informed us of for the last 30 or 40 years, where we've had about 99% of contracts completed without strike, only two in state service since 1980, and even a greater number not without strikes in local government, we've guaranteed under Representative Drazkowski's bills that we'll have strikes all over this state, nonstop. Teachers won't be teaching, workers won't be working. We'll have disruptions everywhere. And apparently management doesn't know how to negotiate a contract. Again, I'm not going to sit here today and tell management what provisions to put in the contract to make sure that steps or insurance don't continue into the next contract, but I could write them for them. Apparently they don't know how to do it. I'd suggest they get new negotiators who do know how to do it, because I can do it, and I'm sure they can do it if they so desired. But what they're trying to do here is change the balance of power from an equal playing field to a field that is no longer equal, which is what Representative Drazkowski and his friends have been doing since last year. Representative Mr. Stanton is absolutely correct. He's absolutely correct. We have faced bill after bill after bill, and Mr. Kajewski is correct. You know, I negotiated the last three state contracts. In 2003, 2005, we were late, and we were late because there was a state shutdown. In 07, 09, 09, 11, we finished on time. We would have loved to have finished the contract, but the state shut down because there was a refusal to compromise. And let's be clear, Mr. Kajewski said 5%, I'll be clearer. State workers, through no fault of their own, victims of a shutdown of a political game, they lost $65 million in wages. And this state lost $65 million in economic activity. That's what was lost during the strike, the shutdown. But something much more valuable was lost. And that continues to be lost as Representative Drazkowski and others continue to put up bill after bill that demonizes, denigrates, and attacks public workers as the cause for problems that they have not been the cause of. And that is, it destroys the morale of public workers in state service. It treats them as if they're animals. It treats them as if they don't have value, that they don't come to work every day to do their jobs and work hard like every other Minnesotan, that they pay taxes, that they have homes, that they have families. But Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski apparently wants to take away their right to bargain. Let me just share with you that this is not the first bill that we've seen from Representative Drazkowski about this. Let's be clear about what's at stake here. He wants to eliminate the right of public workers to bargain. Works for the organization, or represents the organization, the American Legislative Exchange Council, funded by large corporations to sell millions of dollars to take away workers' rights. In House File 1159 last time, Representative Drazkowski wanted to freeze the pay of state workers for 2 years, eliminate the right to bargain and strike. We've seen bills to hold back income for performance pay.
I'm sorry, could you just please limit it to this bill and let's not discuss other bills until when and if they come before the committee? Thank you.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that, but what I'm trying to demonstrate here is that this is a pattern. This is a pattern of an attack on the workers' right to bargain. We've seen 60 toxic bills. We've seen bill after bill. We've seen constitutional amendments to take away workers' right to bargain. This is not simply a little bill. This is a bill that fundamentally will change the relationship at the bargaining table. And a number of representatives at this table have pointed out, apparently management wants extra help from the legislature because they believe they can get it right now. And apparently they don't know how to do their jobs in writing contracts. But in the first section of this bill, the process is modified. But in the last section of the bill on retroactivity, Representative Drazkowski, not just in favor of changing the process to favor management, wants to then decide the outcome of negotiations so that retroactivity would be impossible. I would inform the committee, Madam Chair, and Representative Drazkowski, the retroactivity is never automatic. We take a chance when we go past the expiration agreement. Sometimes we get it, sometimes we don't. And if management's had such a hard time the last few years, then I'd like to know how we had four zeros in the last 8 years in state service, how local government contract after local government contract, including the counties represented by Mr. Carlson, have had zero after zero, have had increases in health payments out of pockets for workers, have seen the erosion of their contracts and their benefits and their wages over the last 8 years. These are facts. These are not fiction under the current law. So I would suggest, Madam Chair and members of this committee, that the process is working, that we ought to stop spending session after session, committee after committee, bill after bill, attacking workers' rights to collective bargaining, and start treating the workers of this state and the workers of government like they're doing something to favor the people of this state, because they get up every day, they work hard, all they want are decent wages and a right to have a voice in the workplace. Representative Drazkowski and others want to take it away. We oppose this bill. You should vote it down and end this attack on workers.
Thank you. We'll move on to the next testifier, Mr. Toburn. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Matt Toburn, and I represent SEIU Local 284, a union of public school support staff. So we're your school bus drivers, your school secretaries, food service workers, paraprofessionals, and those folks. Want to testify in opposition to this bill and sort of give you a unique perspective that school support staff face with this bill and these challenges that I think are unique from some of the other testifiers that you've just heard. It is very, very frequent for our members to often go 6 months to a year before they settle a contract once their contract has expired. And that's not due to any ill will or dragging of feet by the employees, and it's not due to any ill will or dragging the feet of the employers. The school support staff, as we rightly know, are sort of the little guys in the school. And so the school districts typically prefer to settle with the teachers first before moving on to the other staff in the building. And so we often wait in line for that large contract to be settled before we start. And now without the January 15th deadline, which never applied to the support staff to begin with, those contracts we're seeing going out even farther and farther. So it's very common for us to negotiate and to settle a contract that has expired for a while. And it's very, very common for health insurance or wage increases to be retroactively given. And that's not something that the district is doing unwillingly. It's not something that the district doesn't want to do. But it's something that commonly happens. And under the provisions in this bill, even if the employer and the school district wanted to give a retroactive pay raise, they couldn't do it. They couldn't do it because of line 1.14, the parties may not agree to extend or honor a contract term beyond the expiration date of this contract. And then also in section 2, where an employer may not enter into a contract that would retroactively provide a wage or salary increase. So not only does this tie the hands of the employees, but it ties the hands of the school board and the school district. So for any of you who have sat on a school board previously, this should give you concern as well. And for that and all the other reasons that have been mentioned before me, this bill, and would ask you to do the same. Thank you. And there was questions about where the teachers stand, and I believe we have a representative of the teachers here as well.
Thank you. I do have a list here, so I'd like to go to the next witness on the list next, and then if there's time, we'll have you come in. Mr. Johnson, Bob Johnson.
Representative. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Members. My name is Robert Johnson. I represent 11,000 Teamster members of Local 320. And a lot has been said here this morning. This is a bad bill. There is a bill here that a solution looking for a problem. We've had good faith negotiations in this state between employer and employees for years and years. PELRA has worked. It has been a model. And this assault on employees has been going on now for 2 years. And I agree with those that have testified that public employees just cannot take any more of this. We have no proactive stance anymore. Everything we do is reactive to those that would want to take away benefits, salary, and even pension benefits. So on behalf of Teamsters, we strongly oppose this bill.
Thank you, and I appreciate your brief testimony. Looks like we do have a little bit of time, so if you would like to come and if you could keep your comments brief, that'd be great. But do identify yourself first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Louise Sun, and I'm representing both Education Minnesota and the Minneapolis Active and Retired Teachers. I'm sorry to try to butt into line. It's something that teachers should never, ever do, since we teach everybody not to do that. I just have 3 points. My first one is timing. The timing for teacher negotiations is usually during the summer, and it's so because teachers who are on the negotiating teams teach until the middle of June, and they absolutely will not leave their classrooms these days. There was a time when they did were willingly leaving their classrooms. They really can't do that anymore. They don't want to do that anymore, and so that would only leave us about a few weeks in which to settle a very complicated contract. It's not enough time, and for the teachers and their teams to do the research and the actual time at the table to negotiate a good contract means they need all of the summer, and then hopefully they've got a leg up. I negotiated over my 22 years 11 two-year contracts. Of the 11, 10 were in a timely fashion using that methodology and timing, and also the one that went to arbitration was because we had a rookie superintendent, and I won't say that who that was because you'd all know. The next point is the method of negotiations. If we were back in the old days, back in the days when we would come to the negotiating table, and the old days is a long time ago now, and to beat each other up and to leave one side bloody in the streets and the other side victorious, or go to strike. The last time that happened in my experience was in 1970. Now that's a long time ago. And we don't do it that way anymore because that's not a good way to reach a really good settlement that works for children, works for the professionals who work with children. And so now we do principled bargaining. And principled bargaining is we used to be called win-win, but it's kind of hard to call what we end up with now win-win. But it's a recognized process of bargaining in which we get training, we work together on mutual goals, and come out with what we believe is a better working relationship and a better set of language with which to teach kids in a quality way. Now, using my Twin Cities Area Labor Management Council hat, we do that training, and we do expect that the labor management folks that we in districts that we work with, that they will use that process in negotiations. That's a lengthy process. It cannot be done in a month. It can't be done in that period of time. Finally, the technical reality. The technical reality is that changing, for instance, our Q-comp model in salary is a very complicated activity. It is not something where you punch a couple of interest rates into the computer and the salary schedule has changed. Every single salary now is different. If the district, which they're trying to now, to do away with the alternative compensation model, do away with QComp, it takes a long time. So let's say we don't settle and they do what they want to do, change the computer, then hypothetically 6 months down the road, if we ever do come to a resolution, not including the retroactivity, as this bill says, even then changing to some other kind of salary schedule is just fraught with danger.
If you could just kind of start to wrap it up, that'd be great.
I am done. The reality is that with pensions included, with class size being paid for in the contract, being all of those things that need to be recalculated by computers, we have had a major disaster in that area. It's called SAP. Don't ever do it. And the bottom line then, my final comment is that the level playing field under this bill is gone. But what else is gone is the W. Edward Demings was the father of quality management, and his number one tenet, no matter what he was talking about, was value the employees. Value the employees. This bill does not value employees. And my final question to you is, with all of these machinations, with never ever coming to a respectful agreement that's good for children and teachers, who in the future do you expect to teach the children? Certainly not the best and the brightest will come into this activity. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other member questions? So if we're about ready for vote, I think we've had a good discussion here. Representative Nelson?
Madam Chair, I request a roll call.
Roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Pepin?
Aye.
Representative Murray?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative Beard?
Aye.
Representative Hancock?
Aye.
Representative Hornstein?
No.
Representative O'Driscoll?
I'm sorry, aye.
Representative Simon?
No.
Representative Quam?
Agreed.
Oh. Representative Erdahl?
That's no.
Yes, today.
Representative Sanders?
Aye.
Representative Scalzi?
No.
Representative Winkler?
No.
And tomorrow, too.
Well, Frank.
There being 8 ayes and 5 nays, the motion does prevail, and the bill is recommended to pass.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think since we do have some folks here that might be interested in House File 1975, if it's okay with members, in case there's anyone here who can't make it tomorrow but want to testify in this, it'd be okay with you, Representative Drazkowski. I'd like to open it up before you present your bill just to see if anybody here would really like to testify but can't come here tomorrow before we leave today. Is there anybody that would like to testify to House File 1975 that can't be here tomorrow? Thank you, Mr. Side. And I apologize for kind of going out of order here, but this will allow us to get some work done still today. Thank you, Mr. Side. And again, if you can identify yourself.
Thank you again, Madam Chair. My name is Elliot Side. I'm the Executive Director of AFSCME Council 5. Council 5 opposes this bill. Once again, just another attempt to denigrate and contract out and privatize the work of public workers. Public workers already, have the ability. There's contracting that gets done all the time. The state has a plethora of contracts for various services. It happens all the time. This bill is meant to protect the investment that the state has made in public workers, in training, in education, to do a job. And then once they do that job, that they should be able to continue to work that job and not just to have that investment contracted out in the community. At a meeting with our members last year, Representative Drazkowski suggested that contracting out wasn't sufficient, that in fact our members could be replaced, and Human Services could take direct care of people and the mentally ill, the developmentally disabled, folks with dementia, that they could be contracted out with a baby monitor, which you could go pick up in a store. And if you don't believe that, then you should watch the exchange on YouTube. Apparently, baby monitors can replace workers now who are taking care of clients who have dementia, who have no idea if it's day or night, if it's morning or afternoon, or when it is. Or people like my father, who when he was passing would ask me all the time, he wasn't sure what day it was, what week it was, where he was. I assure the Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, that their baby monitors would not have helped my father figure out what was going on in that situation. This legislation and this public policy was created many years ago to ensure continuity of service, to ensure that when the state invests and trains people, that investment and training be worth something and that it be carried out. Most of the issues when we look at privatization, we need to look at the additional costs of privatization. First of all, oversight. If you're going to contract something out, then you're going to need some agency or some persons to oversee what happened with that work. Are you getting what you wanted for the contract that you vended out? Is there some kind of oversight? Secondly, you need to deal with accountability. If the job doesn't get done, who's going to be accountable for that? I can tell you instance after instance over the years, and I'll just give you one. This was in Bemidji many years ago, where at a semaphore, a light was put up by a private contractor. The whole intersection was screwed up. The state workers had to, in fact, fix that. The costs were not applied to the private contractor, but the costs were applied to the State Department of Transportation, who had to fix the work because the contractor hadn't done their job. So you need oversight, you need accountability, and if there's a problem, if there's an accident or another situation, who's liable? The state, the contractor, raises a lot of issues. This public policy hasn't stopped the state from contracting intelligently since this statute was created. In fact, I think if you check, you'll find that the state does millions and millions and millions of dollars worth of contracts. So if it doesn't inhibit contracting, then what's the purpose of the bill? The purpose of the bill is to replace people who have health insurance and a pension with people who are making minimum wage, have no health insurance, have no pension, and by the way, for whom government will then have to pick up the costs because they either have no health care or they don't have enough money to live in a home or get food or a variety of other things. We're talking about replacing good-paying jobs, not great-paying jobs, good-paying jobs with good benefits, with jobs of people who have either minimum wage, no health insurance, or no pension. That's the purpose of the bill. And so, on behalf of AFSCME Council 5, we would oppose this. It is part of the continuing attack. I know, Madam Chair, you don't want me to talk about other bills, but bill after bill after bill that comes in that tries to say that public workers are a problem to the state of Minnesota instead of a precious resource. People who ought to be treated with some respect instead of being treated as disposable objects. We reject the bill and we urge the committee to vote no. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone have any questions for Mr. Seid? Okay, at this time, what I'm going to do then is I will move House File 1975 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to State Government Finance, and I will lay it over. We will take it up first thing tomorrow. Anything else for the committee? Right. Meeting adjourned.